Dr. Halo's meeting.
So I think I may have a very ambitious goal here in a conference where we're talking about everything that we don't know about dark matter and everything we don't know about dark matter. I'm going to say about how we can use dark matter to learn something about a topic we know even less about, and that is the thermal history of the universe prior to Big Bang nuclear synthesis. So as Chris already advertised, this is a paper that we just finished, and it's going to be appearing in PRD pretty shortly. So I'll start just by kind of introducing to the early universe, and it's not really the a common topic of this workshop, and then talk about how we track the evolution of perturbations through reheating, and what the reheating epoch does to the matter transfer spectrum, the matter power spectrum, and then finally end with the substructures that actually follow from this model. So, what happened before Big Bang nuclear synthesis? First of all, let's pause and say, you know, how wonderful Big Bang nuclear synthesis actually is. It's one of the crowning achievements of cosmology. It has mostly successful predictions. I know there's a little problem with lithium, but other than that, it's doing just great. And the one thing it tells us without any uncertainty is that the universe was radiation dominated during Big Bang nuclear synthesis. But we have very good reason to think that the universe was not exclusively radiation dominated from the Big Bang up to nuclear synthesis. For one, the primordial density fluctuations are pointing us towards inflation. So that's scalar domination right there. And so you have to end scalar domination somehow and get to radiation domination. After that, other scale fields might come to dominate the universe. In particular, string theory has the string moduli problem, a bunch of gravitationally coupled light scalars that come to dominate the universe before BBN, and it's actually a challenge to get them to go away before BBN and not mess with BBN. Because that is the first rule of this game, is do not mess with BBN. And so the parameter here is the reheat temperature. That's the temperature at radiation domination. Note that is not the hottest temperature in the universe. The universe is hotter earlier. It's just not radiation dominated. That's also the temperature at which photons are no longer being created, that photon number is starting to be conserved. So if you have a low reheat temperature, what this does is affects your abundance of neutrinos. So if you dial down the reheat temperature, the photons that are made right before reheating aren't hot enough to thermally produce neutrinos in the usual way, and you end up with fewer and fewer effective neutrinos. And that leads to a slower expansion rate during BBN. If that was the only thing that happened, it would lead to a suppression of the helium abundance. But because there are fewer neutrinos around, it also leads to earlier neutron freeze-out, which actually serves to push up your helium abundance. Now, in the past couple years, because of the exquisite precision of the CMB and matter power spectrum observations, the real limiting factor is the fact that fewer neutrinos mean earlier matter radiation equality. And when you put all those constraints together, from deuterium and CMB and large scale structure, you basically end up with a bound of a reheat temperature of greater than 3 MeV. So not all that hot. So I'm going to be talking about a very simple model of reheating. I'm going to assume that the universe was once dominated by an oscillating scalar field. So it's a scalar field that has reached its minimum and is going back and forth. This could be reheating after inflation. It could be the domination of a secondary field, like in the curvaton scenario. It could be a string modulus. And then I'm going to be talking about scalar domination ending when the scalar field decays. And I'm going to be assuming perturbative decay, partly so I get a low reheat temperature, and also scalar decays that can directly go into dark matter. I'll be keeping the reheat temperature as an unknown, just saying that it has to be greater than 3 MeV. Now, the thing about an oscillating scalar field is that it's very analogous to matter, because over many oscillations, the average pressure is zero. So its homogeneous density redshifts just like matter. And it was very recently shown and confirmed that your intuition is correct. The scale field density perturbations grow linearly with the scale factor during scalar domination. But the question we wanted to ask was, what happens to these perturbations after reheating? So our model, our very simple model of reheating, is just that we have some kind of scalar field. And I call it a scalar field partly of confusion. It could be just a heavy, massive particle that decayed. It doesn't necessarily have to be a scalar field, but we have some prime candidates for it if it is. That goes into radiation and matter. So it's just dumping its energy with some kind of decay rate. And that energy is being split between matter and radiation. And notice what's not here is any sort of self-annihilation. I'll come back to that later. Basically, what I'm assuming here by neglecting it is that the dark matter created via scalar decay dominates over any residual relic component, and that the annihilation rate is weak enough that these decay-produced dark matter particles don't self-annihilate. But I'll come back to that a little bit at the end. So what this universe does is if we start out at some value of the scale field, the scale factor 1, we start with scalar domination, and then at a given time, specified by the decay rate, the scalar vanishes, and we pick up radiation and matter. During scalar domination, the radiation and the matter are both redshifting waves a to the minus 3 halves. So their density is still going down. The radiation is still cooling. It's just that particle number and photon number is not being conserved. And then finally, let me mention that this branching ratio, this F that splits the energy deposit into radiation dark matter, is totally determined by the reheat temperature based on the fact that we know when matter radiation equality was. So that's my playground. That's where I'm going to, work my magic. Now let's look at how these perturbations in the matter and radiation evolve through this process. So let's start with the radiation perturbation. First, let's remember what happens to radiation perturbations just in the standard scenario. In the standard scenario, I've got the density, fractional over density here in green. It's constant and in conformal Newtonian gauge, so it's constant until horizon entry, and then it begins to oscillate. Once the potential here, phi in red, decays away, the equations just become a very simple simple harmonic oscillator between the density fluctuation and the velocity fluctuation. So you end up with simple oscillations with a set amplitude determined by the initial conditions. If you couple this to the scalar field, you dramatically change the picture. And that's because you pick up these source terms due to the fact that scalar decays are creating photons. And what that does is because these terms grow during scalar domination, its sources growth in the radiation overdensity as well until scalar domination ends. And then it takes a nosedive. It still oscillates at late times, but it's so small you can't even see it on this plot, and this is the same scale. The amplitude of the oscillations is suppressed by about a factor of 70. So let's look at another example of a mode that spent longer inside the horizon before reheating. So this was the mode we saw. It grew and then died. This one enters in about the same time, but now scalar domination lasts longer. And so it enters in, it grows until it plateaus, it evens out. And what's happening here is that the source term is being canceled by the velocity. The velocity perturbation is actually compensating and swallowing up all of the growth in the scalar perturbation. When the scalar perturbation gets turned off, when the coupling gets turned off because the scalar disappears, we still end up with oscillations that are even smaller. And so what this means is that the impact of scalar domination on the radiation perturbation can be thought of as a transfer function. For very, very small modes, and these are very small modes, we're looking at three orders of magnitude of suppression in the radiation perturbation. This grows up a little bit as you approach horizon entry at reheating, and then levels out at the factor of 10 ninths for modes that enter the horizon after reheating. This is exactly just the inverse of your usual 9/10 as you go from matter to radiation. So if the dark matter couples to radiation after reheating, this is going to lead to a suppression of the power spectrum. Now, it probably won't be the dominant suppression. Some kind of free streaming or kinetic decoupling might happen later. But in some weakly coupled models of dark matter, this could be the dominant cutoff. And so it's something that should be considered. However, for the rest of the time, I'm just going to talk about the matter perturbation. So this is the matter, dark matter produced in scalar decays. And the reason I'm going to focus on the matter perturbation is because it gets to grow. It actually does remember the effect of reheating. And the reason there is because even though it's coupled to the scalar perturbation, because dark matter and the scalar both have zero pressure, they can grow in sync. There's no tension between them. So even though they're coupled, that coupling is initially satisfied and just continues to be satisfied throughout the evolution. So the dark matter perturbation doesn't do anything weird like the radiation perturbation did. It does exactly what you'd expect it to do. It enters the horizon, it grows linearly, and switches over the logarithmic growth once the scalar decays. And so you can model, just by solving the perturbation equations during scalar domination, for what this linear growth is given by, as a linear in A, once A exceeds the horizon crossing time. And then after reheating, you can assume it's going to grow logarithmically. That's what we know it's going to do. And so if you just impose the constancy of its derivative times A there, you get a simple model for what it's doing after reheating. And that's shown in the dashed line here. So what if we looked at this as a function of scale? So now I'm evaluating the dark matter perturbation 10 decades in scale factor after reheating. So these modes, these large modes, are still superhorizon. But I will note that they have a little bit of a different initial condition than the initial condition you saw in the previous plots, and that's because superhorizon modes do evolve at reheating. It, like I said, it's the exact analog of what you're used to with the transition of radiation to matter domination, just in reverse. Also, you pick up the appropriate adiabatic initial condition for the radiation perturbation and the dark matter. So you just end up with adiabatic perturbations exactly like you'd expect. And so that's why this is 5/3. Modes that have already entered the horizon are exactly modeled by your basic standard evolution that you can pick out of a textbook. So the transfer function, the matter power spectrum, is not at all affected for these modes. But however, the modes that entered the horizon during scalar domination don't follow the standard model at all. They shoot up here. And just from the fact that we saw they were proportional to the amount of time the mode spent inside the horizon before reheating leads to a k-squared dependence on the dark matter. And that's what's shown here. Plus linear growth, logarithmic growth. And so now this becomes a transfer function. So we usually define the transfer function as just we take out this factor of k squared and then define the transfer function. And we saw that for these modes, the density perturbation is proportional to k squared already, which is telling you the transfer function is constant. And indeed, here's the expression you get for it. The key here is that you notice it only depends on the duration of the radiation-dominated era. And that's because the transfer function always just parameterizes deviations from linear growth. And the only deviation from linear growth that these modes had was the fact that they kind of had to cool their heels during radiation domination. So the amplitude is constant, just depends on when reheating happened. And you can see it's a smooth turnover for different values of the reheat temperature. Scales that entered the horizon end up with flat, whereas the baseline here is your usual log k over k squared. So, what does that do for the density fluctuation? The transfer function is only going to affect scales that have co-moving radius less than the reheat scale. So we can define a reheating horizon mass to be the mass within this co-moving radius. And here's what it is. So we're looking at halos with tens to hundreds Earth mass, microhalos, are what's going to be affected. And you can look at the density contrast as a function of microhalo mass for different values of the reheat temperature again. And you see that it's very, very, very flat for high values of the reheat temperature, as expected. But then you get power law increases. The power law just follows from the fact that this is a power law cosmology. It's not the power law cosmology that Larry was just telling us about, because it's now the effective index really is 1. But it is a power law cosmology. It has a simple power law scaling for sigma m, and that's exactly what you're seeing here at different turnups at smaller and smaller mass scales as you change the reheat temperature. Sigma m is the average density fluctuation averaged over scales containing mass m. Okay, what about free streaming? This is, so far I've just assumed that dark matter is born completely cold. What does free streaming do to this picture? Well, free streaming will serve to suppress power on scales larger than the free streaming horizon, which is just given by the average velocity dispersion of the dark matter particles. And so you can account for this by just inserting an extra exponential factor into your transfer function that cuts it off on small scales. So what I'm going to do to just parameterize this, remember, I don't really have a firm dark matter particle in mind just yet. So let me just parameterize this as the average particle velocity at reheating. This is not necessarily the average particle velocity when the dark matter was created. Some dark matter is created earlier because the scalar field is constantly decaying. But a lot of the dark matter is created at reheating. So you can think of it like this. And for a range of reheat temperatures, what we found is that the ratio of the reheat scale to the free streaming scale is roughly just proportional to this mean velocity over about a factor of 0.06. So what this is telling us, because if we're going to have any hope of seeing this modified structure evolution, we need this ratio to be less than 1, which is telling us that we're going to need average velocity dispersions that are fairly small, 10 to the minus 3 times the speed of light. What this does to sigma m, so here I have sigma m again. The red is what you've seen before. This is all for a reheat temperature of 8.5 MeV. And now I'm adding in some velocity. And you can see for 0.01, I lost it all. It's just all my extra growth has been totally removed by free streaming. For the other smaller values of the velocity, I still get some growth. The power law has been altered slightly. And then it levels off at masses at the free streaming scale. So we do need the dark matter to be pretty cold at reheating. Yes, this is right now, no, the dark matter is born from scalar decay and never ever talks to the radiation. So this leads to the punchline of what's the consequence? I've just changed the power spectrum in a very radical way. From perturbations to microhalos, I would really love to do an n-body simulation, but I haven't had a chance to do that yet, so I'm just going to use press sector to get a handle for what my altered power spectrum has done to my dark matter mass function. And so instead of looking at the number density of halos, I'm going to look at the fraction of dark matter that is bound in objects of a given mass per ln mass bin. And the reason I want to do this is I'm going to be really focusing at this on high redshifts. The problem with press sector is it doesn't do subhalos. So these are microhalos. They are going to form at high redshift, and then they're going to, you know, slowly be absorbed into bigger objects, as we'll go through systematically how that happens. So I'm going to be looking at this at high redshift to get a sense for, at high redshift, how much of the dark matter is bound up in objects. And the key ratio that comes in here again and again is the ratio of sigma m to the critical overdensity for collapse, 1.68. And you'll see the halos with sigma m less than the critical overdensity are very rare. These are the ones that are exponentially suppressed. And so we can define a critical mass scale. And so here's this critical mass scale defined by this relation as a function of redshift. So in green, we have the standard case. The standard case is steep. This is basically the exact same problem Larry was mentioning, that all structures form at the same time in the standard case because, as you can see, changing the redshift just a little bit, I just went up 16 orders of magnitude in mass scale. Not so in this scenario, because once you turn on the reheat temperature, things level out. So let's look a little more in detail about what this is actually telling us. The key here is, again, our friend, the reheat horizon mass. And so what we see, this is for reheat temperature of 8.5 MeV. The reheat horizon mass is 54 Earth masses. The minute M-stir falls below the reheat horizon mass, that's when this power law picks up. And the same for the higher reheat temperature. And the power law, of course, just directly follows from the power law in sigma. So you get the same power law in an M-stir. Exactly what the exponent is depends a little bit on what you're assuming for your growth function. And then finally, look at what happens with free streaming. The difference is not that profound. Notice I've taken off the hundredth of speed of light value because that was just gone anyway. That's going to pretty much just track this. But for the smaller velocities, it really doesn't do that much. It slightly makes it a little more shallow. That comes from changing the slope of sigma m. And it reduces it a little bit, but not even by an order of magnitude. And that's because the free streaming mass here, which I've shown for this reheat temperature, for the other reheat temperature, it's below the plot. Even out to a redshift of 500, M-star hasn't reached it yet. If I continued this plot out here, then you'd see a dramatic cutoff due to free streaming. But because by redshift 500 hasn't reached it, that's why the effects are so minimal. So now let's look at that bound fraction and what it does. So this is the differential bound fraction. This is the percentage of dark matter that's contained in objects of this mass. And I'm focusing now on the low reheat temperature. Everything I say can basically be just scaled by the reheat horizon to change the reheat horizon mass to change the reheat temperature. Basically, it just rescales this axis. So at high redshift, what happens is I'm firmly in this power law regime. And for the power law regime, Prefschechter tells me that the bound fraction has a very specific shape. It's peaked at M-star. And this shape just follows M-star at higher and higher redshifts. So if I showed redshifts beyond 100, you'd see exactly the same shape as this red curve, just at lower and lower masses. It's just tracking M-star. Once we get to higher masses, now we're getting to the point where M-star and the reheat horizon mass are starting to become comparable. Then you start to see a little deviation in the shape. And finally, once M-star becomes greater than the horizon mass that we're heating, then the peak location freezes. It just hits a brick wall and just starts to go down. And we'll see in a minute, what's really this is telling you is that these things are getting absorbed into larger halos. So let's put in some integrals. Let's consider the fraction of dark matter bound in halos with mass greater than a tenth of an Earth mass in this scenario. So in this case, a tenth of the Earth mass is about 0.05 the reheating horizon mass. So at a redshift of 100, the standard scenario has virtually no bound structures. In this scenario, it's half already bound up. Redshift of 50, again, now we're starting to see a little bit of growth on the standard case. 71% of the dark matter is bound up in microhalos. By redshift of 25, now we're starting to see these are the kind of normal Earth mass microhalos people have studied. Already 83% of the universe is bound up in microhalos just smaller than the reheat horizon mass. So we're talking about most of the dark matter in bound compact structures that form at very, very high redshift. What does free streaming do? Well, remember what free streaming did to M-star, i.e. not much. It just changed the value of M-star just slightly. Let me also remind you what it did to sigma M. It changed the slope just a little bit. And from those two features, you can predict that free streaming will lead to microhalos with slightly smaller masses because M-star is a little smaller. and then a slightly less abundant because the bound fraction is proportional to the slope of sigma. And that's exactly what you see. If you add in some velocity, it just shifts the peak just a little bit to smaller masses and just a little smaller amplitude. Nothing too dramatic. So the lesson here is that free streaming is really kind of all or nothing. Either it's going to erase everything, or it's going to be an order unity correction. So, what now? At the universe at high redshift is very, very clumpy. What happens to these halos? Well, now I'm plotting the differential bound fraction. I've switched to logarithmic space so that you can see the dotted lines here are the pure radiation-dominated standard scenario. And what you're seeing is, like I pointed out before, at low redshift, this peak amplitude is going down. Notice it's still pretty significant. But what's happening is that the formation of larger structures is taking over. And the formation of larger structures happens exactly as it does in the standard scenario. You see that for masses greater than about 10 times, even just equal to the horizon mass at reheating, we're totally back onto the standard case. Now, so these microhalos are getting absorbed. What happens to them? Well, there's been a lot of work done on the survival probability for the standard microhalos. All I can say about these is they formed a lot earlier, which means they are a lot denser. So if you think that your standard microhalos have even the smallest chance of surviving, these things are going to survive in tremendous numbers. Not only that, there are more of them to begin with. So even if only 1% survive, you're still going to end up with a lot of the dark matter bound up into substructures. And I'm citing a paper here that actually plotted a survival rate as a function of density and found that microhalos, say, forming at a redshift of 300 actually has a 90% survival rate compared to a microhalo forming at, like, redshift 17, which is more like a 10%.
They could be disrupted in their other slightly larger microhalos.
This is true, and this is what Peshekta doesn't really get at, and I would really love to do a scale invariant n-body simulation to see exactly, if you have a flat transfer function, what exactly happens. Because you're right, now I no longer have the problem scale, small scales form earlier and earlier and earlier. Peshekta just says that, yes, indeed, your peak is going to shift over, but exactly what kind of form, density profile, survival, I don't know the details beyond that. I would like to do an in-body simulation.
Do it semi-analytically, with semi-analytic code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is. I will totally admit this is a first pass. This is a candle in a dark room, but right now it's just a new idea. It definitely can use a more sophisticated treatment. This is the area where they could absolutely use a more sophisticated treatment, and that is, how would you find these things? Now, as Chris mentioned in his talk, the only thing we know for sure about dark matter is it does gravitate. And so you can look for these things in various means of microlensing. So last year, I wrote a paper with an astronomer at U of T looking at astrometric microlensing by normal subhalos. And what you find is, as the subhalo center moves, all the stars in the field of view within 10 arc seconds or so around it also get a little shifts in their positions at the order of micro arc seconds. This is very, very challenging to observe. But these halos are denser, and so their signal might be larger. However, they're also a little smaller. So I'm not sure if they're detectable via astrometric microlensing, but it's definitely something worth looking into. Another possibility is pulsar timing. Niyash has worked on this and also found that the standard scenario, the subhalos are too diffuse and too rare to make an appreciable residual in pulsar timing due to Shapiro time delay. However, again, now we have denser subhalos and a lot more of them. So it's worth, re-examining this. And finally, these things might be dense enough even to go after with photometric microlensing. They're not as dense as the so-called ultra-compact microhalos that Riccati and Gould considered, but they're somewhere in between. So these are things to consider. The more, you know, rock solid detection would be if dark matter self-annihilates. This would be a boost factor to exceed all boost factors. This would be, you know, enormous. But notice I haven't mentioned anything about sigma V except at the very beginning. I have no idea what sigma V is in these models. And in fact, work is done a few years ago, I'm stealing this paper from Ganilli and Gandola et al. From 2006, shows that when you put the reheat temperature into the picture, you know nothing about sigma V. So what this is plotting is the abundance as a function of lower reheat temperature and increasing direct non-thermal dark matter. So the models that I've considered basically are like these models. You can see that it's, these are, by the way, just a scan of Dirac-Susi parameter space. So all these scatter different self-annihilation cross-sections. The models that I've considered so far are basically these, that all of those points collapse to a single line because the only thing that matters is the direct decay products. But if you have, if you consider this full picture, some of these are going to self-annihilate. Some of them are also going to have structure. The lesson that these authors pointed out was basically if you start from the standard case, you can either move all of Dirac-Susi below the observed abundance, which is the red line, or above the observed abundance. You can get the right relic abundance with any sigma V you possibly want. And this lesson here was that the Wnt miracle is, you know, very poorly constrained once you start taking into account the uncertainty in the reheat temperature. However, I'm hoping that this could be another dimension on this plot, that there's another axis here of boost factor and how much substructure you get. And maybe that can shed light on this rather confusing situation. So I'll summarize and wrap up here, because I know it's past time for lunch. So basically what we've shown is that perturbations that enter the horizon prior to reheating are very different than the larger perturbations. The radiation perturbations get dramatically suppressed. The dark matter perturbations get dramatically enhanced. And that enhancement leads to an abundance of microhalos, the mass scale being set by the reheating horizon mass. And that these microhalos form very early, at high redshift, fresh sector at least, is pointing to the fact that half of the dark matter is bound into microhalos. These might be detectable through gravitational lensing, and maybe with some kind of combination of indirect detection, we can get at both the reheat history and the thermal or non-thermal origin of dark matter. And like I said, this is kind of a candle in a dark room, so stay tuned. I think that there's a lot of good possibility here. And then there's the address for the paper that we've already finished. Thank you.
Couple comments, I guess, or questions. In the astrometric test that you explored, since you have such a large number of microhalos, you would get that kind of a distortion field from a whole bunch of different things at the same time, so
it might have to be more like the approach that was used with the pulsar timing, that you're just looking for more scatter.
Right.
Rather than, you know, an isolated, oh, the star went from here to here. Yeah, you're more looking at something like Gaia or Siv just having way too much noise
and not
understanding why.
And a second quick thing, in terms of the using microlensing and cosmologically distant objects, lensed quasars, there are actually limits you might be able to use even now.
Really? I always thought those were much, much larger mass scales.
It's worth sitting down and working through it briefly, but basically in the microlensing you can see from individual stars in lensing galaxies and lensed quasars, the amount of microlensing you get actually depends on the fraction of point sources to smooth dark matter.
Okay.
And so you can say that the point sources are just stars and work it out. But if you have other point sources like black holes or microhalos or something, you can actually set limits on that. And taking the black hole approach, or setting limits on primordial black holes is a little exercise that I'm doing with Katie Mack, and
okay.
We could recast it in terms of your
We should
hypothesis.
Definitely talk some more, yes. These things are not as point mass-like as you might hope. Their radius is still much larger than their Einstein radius. They're not that compact. I mean, they're forming at redshifts of 200, 300. But so their virial density is much higher, but right. not point mass level. So I'm not sure, but we should definitely talk more about it.
So the crucial ingredient here is the low reheat temperature.
Yes. Well, somewhat. I mean, it depends on.
Because I mean, okay, many inflationary models, we have some. I mean, if it's not instant reheating, you have some matter combination before you get to radiation.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, so, but the thing is that, okay, but with a larger heating temperature, everything drops off. So that's why I'm asking if this is the crucial.
So the reheat temperature definitely sets the mass scale of what objects you're looking at. So if the reheat mass scale is too small, then it kind of becomes the question of, well, how small microhalos are you interested in?
One more question, thanks for tuning in.